Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Well, the Egyptian presidential elections have come and gone. Fear that the military would steal the election turned out to be unfounded. But what happens next? Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs magazine, joins me to discuss that and what it means for the United States. We'll also talk about the new Syria-Turkey tensions, this shootdown of a Turkish plane. Now, Turkey is part of NATO, so that may have implications for the United States, too. Gideon Rose, welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be here, Brian.
First, why did the military allow Mohamed Morsi to claim his presidential victory? They could have annulled the elections or engineered it to have the opposing candidate, the former prime minister in the Mubarak government, Ahmed Shafiq, who was seen as the candidate of the military, win the presidency. A lot of people were really afraid they were going to do that, but they didn't. Why not?
Because they're actually quite clever. And what they wanted to do was to retain power, but to do so with, if possible, a veneer of legitimacy and at the same time defang or at least put pressure on the chief opponent to them domestically, which is the Muslim Brotherhood. By allowing Morsi to win and take office, but in stripping basically all the office of all real power and dissolving the legislature and basically taking steps to run the actual country's affairs, they basically forced the Muslim Brotherhood into the position either of giving a fig leaf of legitimacy to military rule, or by taking the government, by taking the position, or they forced them into the streets in a kind of open opposition, which the military can then use as a pretext for a real violent crackdown. So the military, I think, is clever in letting Morsi take over because either the Muslim Brotherhood accepts the post and therefore is neutered and gives the military a cover for what it's doing, or it turns it down, in which case there can be cracked down upon if they try and go into the streets again and then, you know, be eliminate themselves or marginalize themselves.
Listeners, questions about Egypt or questions about Turkey and Syria, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs and author of the book How Wars End, 212-433-9692. What did you mean just now when you said the Egyptian military essentially stripped the presidency of its meaningful powers? How did they do that?
They've done a whole variety of things in recent months. They've basically done away with the charade of any kind of democratic transition in a series of power grabs that have bookended the actual presidential vote. They reimposed martial law. They issued a supplemental constitutional declaration that gave them legislative authority and reinforced their ability to draft a permanent constitution along the lines they want. They exempted themselves from civilian oversight, giving themselves the right to appoint and promote leadership of this process, to manage economic projects themselves, and to make arms deals. And then just on June 18th, Field Marshal Tantawi announced the reestablishment of a National Defense Council, putting them firmly in charge of national security policy. So basically, the post that Morsi has doesn't really have much power anymore, and there's no parliament because that's been dissolved. So he really is not going to be anything more than a figurehead without real power. And for all the hoopla over whether he's going to be seated or not, they've managed to basically put the Brotherhood in a really bad position. The only thing I think that could help the transition at this point get back on a democratic track would be some kind of coalition between the Muslim Brotherhood and the liberals, which could really basically put everybody else on the other side from the military and reinvigorate the revolution. But so far that hasn't happened yet. And so the military has been able to sort of divide and conquer its domestic opponents. And I think right now the prospects look pretty bleak.
Well, what about Morsi and the Brotherhood and the liberals? He has made a show, at least, of promising to include at least one Christian and one woman among his top deputies. Is this just a charade, in your opinion, to, calm fears that they're going to head toward a theocracy with the Muslim Brotherhood president? Or do you think it's a real attempt at a Islam-rooted but open democratic government, at least as much as Morsi can control that?
You know, I think it could be that, and it would be great to run that experiment, frankly. We've run the military rule experiment, and it doesn't really get very far, and it doesn't end well. So trying the Islamist liberal coalition route would be something worth doing, I think. But that said, it's easier to say than do, and, you know, the locals have strong distrust between those two camps, and at least as yet, the military's power grab hasn't managed to unite civilian groups against it.
212-433-WNYC. John in Forest Hills, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hi. My question is, in the Egyptian situation, why has the U.S. not put more pressure on the military to because they continue strangling the democratic evolution there. You know, we're still putting in all of our foreign aid, $3.5 billion, and all the diplomatic things that seem to be going on. Seems like there ought to be more push from our end to kind of thwart what the military have been doing.
Well, it's a good question, and there are definitely some people who feel that way. From the perspective of U.S. policy, it's actually a pretty tricky question because, frankly, there aren't a huge lot of great prospects for Egypt politically going forward right now anyway, and it's a little bit of a pick-your-poison kind of move. And the U.S. has a relationship with the Egyptian military, has had a relationship, essentially the kind of old one it had with Mubarak, right, which is you deliver stability and peace with Israel, and you become essentially a nice, docile American client, and will not push you too hard on domestic concerns that you care about and let you get a pass on that. So that policy fell by the wayside when the upheavals in Egypt and Tahrir Square made it impossible. And so we stepped out to a different policy, told Mubarak he had to go pretty much after we knew he was going to go. But we didn't change the fundamental calculus. And now that the military, which is, frankly, the dominant player in society right now, at least in the politics and in the government, in the state, sort of like a deep state, almost like in what they used to say about Turkey. American policy doesn't want to fundamentally alienate the powers that be that are going to be ruling Egypt and keeping American interests secure in the region. So they don't want to put too much pressure on the military. On the other hand, they want the military to do better domestically. And we have the same kind of phenomenon in a lot of countries. I mean, that's exactly what we've been doing with Pakistan. Hasn't worked there, but there's no obvious, easy answer to how to get these militaries to think of their country's long-term interests in a constructive way.
In fact, President Obama called both President-elect Morsi and Ahmed Shafiq after the election a sort of symbolic but unusual move. And I guess that's a sign of how engaged the U.S. still wants to be perceived as being with the military.
Yeah. I mean, you want to – we're trying to keep – look, the Obama administration, frankly, does not want to get involved because this is a loser issue no matter what happens to a certain extent if there's more U.S. involvement. And at the same time, they don't want things to boil over and they want to keep moving things forward. So we use what little pressure we have in some kinds of ways. We're not going to make aid conditional because, frankly, we do have security interests and the issue of the Egypt-Israel relationship that are very strong and very important. And we want those protected. And so the administration is sitting there hoping in Washington hoping that a little bit of jawboning can get things back on track because it doesn't know what else to do.
Could the U.S., as some people have suggested, shift the balance of payments on its aid to Egypt? And by the way, the caller said $3 billion a year plus. I think I've read $1.5 billion a year. Maybe you know the real figure. But in either case, the majority of it goes to the military. I think like three quarters of it goes to the military. And I wonder if there's a case to be made for shifting the percentages and putting more of the U.S. aid that goes to Egypt into civil society building.
First of all, you can't really change the conditions of foreign aid programs and various other kinds of aid programs on a dime easily. These are hard to change, often set in legislative terms, and in general not something that you can manipulate very quickly. Second of all, there are good reasons for not wanting to manipulate aid quickly, turning it on and off, moving it around here and there, because some of its long-term effects depend on a steady flow of things. And third, finally, look, the aid really is a bribe to get the Egyptian military to accept peace with Israel. So although it might have some pernicious effects in other ways domestically, we are at least getting the bribe. We are getting in return what we wanted most with that kind of aid, which is the peace treaty with Israel.
Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs, 212-433-WNYC. Sultan in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hello.
I just wanted to point out that I think the U.S. foreign policy perhaps needs to pay a bit of attention to the fact that even though the Brotherhood may not be angels, but I think a lot of this has to do with trial, if you will, through legitimacy. And I think if we ever expect Muslim Brotherhood-type institutions to be able to operate and to learn a thing or two about democracy, which I think they've taken the first step, then I think we have to be less cynical about these processes. And I think we have to be very careful in how we ally ourselves with the military. I understand the real politique behind all of this, but I think we don't do ourselves and American interests any service by continually acting in the same way as we have done for the last 50 or 60 years, not only in the Middle East, but I think elsewhere as well.
Right. Give Islamist democracy a chance. Let me go right on to another caller who I think is addressing the same issue. Sheba in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes. Thank you very much. I would be interested to hear Mr. Rose's comments on whether the current situation in Egypt, whether you could draw a valid parallel between the relationship between the government and the military in Turkey ever since the Ataturk years. I'd be interested to hear what you think about that.
It's a good question. There are definitely some similarities. You know, Steve Cook, a fellow at the Council, has written usefully on the Egyptian and Turkish militaries, and I think you should take a look at his work. There are some similarities, particularly in those cases, but also more generally in terms of third world militaries. I mean, if you look at what's happening in Pakistan and the difficulty in getting civilian government moving there while we have an alliance with the most powerful actor in the country, the National Security Establishment, which is not particularly democratic or liberal, but important to us in other ways. There are similarities. I think Turkey is a special case because of Ataturk, because of the process there. And I think that the Islamists now actually have a lot more power, obviously, in Turkey than in any of these other countries.
Well, this is what ties.
So in some ways, we hope Turkey is a model.
This is what ties those last two callers together. We often hold up Turkey as a model of a overwhelmingly, you know, Muslim majority country that has a government that has some formal identification with the religion, but also formal identification with a secular civil society democratic process. Do you feel it's working, or were you implying that it's breaking down over time?
No, I actually think, I mean, there are people who are worried about Turkey, and there are very polarized views on Turkey between the secular forces in the military on the one hand and the pro-Islamist forces on the other. If you listen to different Turks, you get very different views on how things are playing out there. But I, like many Americans in the policy establishment, am pretty happy with Turkey. If Turkey could be the model for a lot of these other countries, we would be all quite well off, I think. The challenge is, how do you get there? And it's going to take a long time. I mean, look, we have somewhat too high expectations of the Arab Spring. You had a long-term authoritarian order in the Middle East, which had pernicious consequences in a whole variety of ways, and it was overthrown, or parts of it were overthrown, by local popular uprisings. And there was this sense that, oh my God, this is going to bring in the millennium tomorrow. That was the wonderful heady days of the Arab Spring last year. But the fact is that what you had was the beginning of a long-term process of turbulence and chaos in Middle Eastern politics that may very well end up in a much better place down the road. Certainly the old order wasn't evolving positively. I think the upheavals were a good thing and that we'll ultimately see a lot of progress down the road. But there's going to be a lot of turbulence, and the transitions are going to be slow, halting. They're going to have lots of reversals. You're going to see the stuff you're seeing in Egypt and mm-hmm. elsewhere. All we can hope for is that things don't go too completely crazy in the short term, and that America doesn't get sucked in a really bad way in some particular way as this turbulence plays out over the next years, maybe even decades to come.
And so before you go, on the one particular piece of turbulence taking place right now, Syria, and of course everything that's going on in Syria is turbulent and horrible when I think about, you know, all the risk that the people are at there. But in particular right now, Syria shooting down a Turkish plane that it accused of being on a spy mission over Syrian airspace. Turkey denies that accusation. The lead article in the New York Times today seems to suggest that, yeah, maybe Turkey was flying over Syrian airspace on a spy mission. What's your best information as to who's right and who's wrong here?
You know, it's really hard to say with these incidents, especially early on when the reporting is confused. What I will say is I don't see this as being the spark that's going to escalate the conflict between Syria and Turkey or Syria and NATO. In fact, just the opposite, because, you know, the prospect of a hanging concentrates the mind wonderfully, as the saying goes. And in this case, the prospect of an actual war with outside powers will concentrate everybody's mind wonderfully. And you will, in fact, probably not see an escalation, because nobody actually wants a major war between external players and Syria, including Syria. So the situation in Syria, the civil war there, will continue to fester, and the situation will slide. But like Egypt, it's going to be very turbulent, and we don't know what would come next. The interesting thing, of course,
we just have a minute left. But sure. Turkey is a NATO member, so another argument could be that this is the excuse that the international community needs to actually go into Syria and change that government. You don't think so?
Yeah, I think, let's be honest, I think people are looking for excuses not to go into Syria. They're not looking for excuses to go in, because what do you do when you're there? Mm-hmm. This is a minority government with a repressive state apparatus maintaining order. When that goes, which I hope it does, all hell will break loose in a lot of respects. And that's the last thing NATO actually wants, is to be deeply involved, or at least that's the general feeling, I think.
Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs magazine and author of How Wars End, Why We Always Fight the Last Battle. Thank you for so much clarity.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, why some countries from Mexico to France allow expats to vote in their elections. And then Kurt Anderson from Studio 360 will stop by on entertaining Kings County and redesigning Canada. Some of this will include a 10-question Brooklyn quiz. Stay with us.